to him. At last he was a gentleman in his own right. And this was just the start. He planned to cut a dash in Virginia society. He did not know just how colonial government worked, but he understood they had local leaders called vestrymen, and the assembly in Williamsburg was composed of burgesses, the equivalent of members of parliament. Given his status, he thought he might skip the local stage and stand for election to the House of Burgesses at the earliest opportunity. He wanted everyone to know that J. Jamieson was a man of importance. Lizzie came across the lawn, riding Blizzard, who had survived the voyage unscathed. She was riding him well, J. thought, almost like a man. And then he realized, to his irritation, that she was sitting astride. It was so vulgar for a woman to go up and down like that with her legs apart. When she reined in, he said, "You shouldn't ride like that." She put a hand on her rounded waist. "I've been going very slowly, just walking and trotting." "I wasn't thinking of the baby. I hope nobody saw you riding astride." Her face fell, but her rejoinder was defiant, as always. "I don't intend to ride side saddle out here." "Out here?" he repeated. "What does it matter where we are?" "But there's nobody here to see me." "I can see you, so can the servants, and we might have visitors. You wouldn't walk around naked out here, would you?" "I'll ride side saddle to church, and when we're with company, but not on my own." There was no arguing with her in this mood. "Anyway, quite soon you'll have to stop riding altogether for the sake of the baby," he said sulkily. "But not just yet," she said brightly. She was 5 months pregnant. She planned to stop riding at 6. She changed the subject. "I've been looking around. The land is in better condition than the house. Sowerby is a drunk, but he has kept the place going. We probably should be grateful, considering he hasn't been paid his wages for almost a year."
"He may have to wait a little longer. Cash is short."
"Your father said there were 50 hands, but in fact there are only 25. It's a good thing we have the 15 convicts from the Rosebud." She frowned. "Is McCash among them?"
"Yes."
"I thought I saw him across the fields."
"I told Sowerby to pick out the youngest and strongest." Jay had not realized that McCash was on the ship. If he had thought about it, he might have guessed, and told Sowerby to be sure to leave the troublemaker behind. But now that he was here, Jay was reluctant to send him away. He did not want to appear intimidated by a mere convict. Lizzie said,
"I presume we didn't pay for the new men?"
"Certainly not. Why should I pay for something that belongs to my family?"
"Your father may find out."
"He certainly will. Captain Parridge demanded a receipt for 15 convicts, and naturally I obliged him. He will hand that to Father."
"And then?"
Jay shrugged. "Father will probably send me a bill, which I will pay when I can." He was rather pleased with his little piece of business. He had got 15 strong men to work for 7 years, and it had cost him nothing.
"How will your father take it?"
Jay grinned. "He'll be furious, but what can he do at this distance?"
"I suppose it's all right," Lizzie said dubiously.
He did not like her questioning his judgment. "These things are best left to men." That annoyed her, as always. She went on the attack.
"I'm sorry to see Lennox here. I can't understand your attachment to that man."
Jay had mixed feelings about Lennox. He might be as useful here as he had been in London, but he was an uncomfortable presence. However, once he had been rescued from the hold of the Rosebud, the man had assumed he would be living on the Jamieson plantation, and Jay had never summoned the nerve to discuss the matter. "I thought it would be useful to have a white man to do my bidding," he said airily.
"But what will he do?"
"Sowerby needs an assistant."
"Lennox knows nothing about tobacco, except how to smoke the stuff."
"He can learn. Besides, it's mainly a matter of making the Negroes work."
"He'll be good at that," Lizzie said caustically.
Jay did not want to discuss Lennox. "I may go into public life here," he said. "I'd like to get elected to the House of Burgesses. I wonder how soon it could be arranged."
"You'd better meet our neighbours and talk to them about it."
He nodded. "In a month or so, when the house is ready, we'll give a big party and invite everyone of importance from around about Fredericksburg. That will give me a chance to get the measure of the local gentry."
"A party?" Lizzie said dubiously. "Can we afford it?"
Once again, she was questioning his judgment. "Leave the finances to me," he snapped. "I'm sure we can get supplies on credit. The family has been trading in these parts for at least 10 years. My name must be worth quite a lot." She persisted with her questions.
"Wouldn't it be better to concentrate on running the plantation, at least for a year or two? Then you could be sure you had a solid foundation for your public career."
"Don't be stupid," he said. I didn't come here to be a farmer. The ballroom was small, but it had a good floor and a little balcony for the musicians. 20 or 30 couples were dancing in their bright satin clothes, the men wearing wigs and the women in lacy hats. 2 fiddlers, a drummer and a French horn player were giving a minuet. Dozens of candles lit up the fresh paintwork and floral decorations. In the other rooms of the house, guests played cards, smoked, drank, and flirted. Jay and Lizzie moved from the ballroom to the dining room, smiling and nodding at their guests. Jay was wearing a new apple-green silk suit he had bought in London just before they left. Lizzie was in purple, her favourite colour. Jay had thought their clothes might outshine those of the guests, but to his surprise he found that Virginians were as fashionable as Londoners. He had drunk plenty of wine and was feeling good. They had served dinner earlier, but there were now refreshments on the table. Wine, jellies, cheesecakes, syllabubs, and fruit. The party had cost a small fortune, but it was a success. Everyone who was anyone had come. The only sour note had been struck by the overseer, Sowerby, who had chosen today to ask for his back pay. When Jay told him it was not possible to pay him until the first tobacco crop was sold, Sowerby had insolently asked how Jay could afford to give a party for 50 guests. The truth was that Jay could not afford it. Everything had been bought on credit, but he was too proud to say that to his overseer, so he had told him to hold his tongue. Sowerby had looked disappointed and worried, and Jay had wondered if he had some specific money problem. However, he did not inquire. In the dining room, the Jamiesons' nearest neighbours were standing at the fire eating cake. There were 3 couples, Colonel and Mrs. Thompson, Bill and Susie Delahaye, and the Armstead brothers, 2 bachelors. The Thompsons were very elevated. The Colonel was a Burgess, a member of the General Assembly, grave and self-important. He had distinguished himself in the British Army and the Virginia Militia, then had retired to grow tobacco and help rule the colony. Jay felt he could model himself on Thompson. They were talking politics, and Thompson explained, "The governor of Virginia died last March, and we're waiting for his replacement." Jay assumed the air of an insider in the London court. "The king has appointed Norborn Barclay, the Baron de Bottetourt." John Armstead, who was drunk, laughed coarsely. "What a name!" Jay gave him a frosty look. "I believe the Baron was hoping to leave London soon after I did." Thompson said, "The President of the Council is acting as his deputy in the interim." Jay was keen to show that he knew a lot about local affairs. He said, "I assume that's why the Burgesses were so unwise as to support the Massachusetts letter." The letter in question was a protest against customs duties. It had been sent by the Massachusetts legislature to King George. Then the Virginia legislature had passed a resolution approving of the letter. Jay and most London Tories considered both the letter and the Virginian resolution disloyal. Thompson seemed to disagree. He said stiffly, "I trust the Burgesses were not unwise." "His Majesty certainly thought so," Jay rejoined. He did not explain how he knew what the king thought, but left room for them to suppose the king had told him personally. "Well, I'm sorry to hear that," said Thompson, not sounding sorry at all. Jay felt that he might be on dangerous ground, but he wanted to impress these people with his acumen, so he went on. "I'm quite sure that the new governor will demand that the resolution be withdrawn." He had learned this before leaving London. Bill Delahaye, younger than Thompson, said hotly, "The Burgesses will refuse." His pretty wife, Susie, put a restraining hand on his arm, but he felt strongly, and he added, "It's their duty to tell the king the truth, not mouth empty phrases that will please his Tory sycophants." Thompson said tactfully, "Not that all Tories are sycophants, of course." Jay said, "If the Burgesses refuse to withdraw their resolution, the governor will have to dissolve the assembly." Roderick Armstead, soberer than his brother, said, "It's curious how little difference that makes nowadays." Jay was mystified. "How so? Colonial parliaments are constantly being dissolved for one reason or another. They simply reassemble informally in a tavern or a private house and carry on their business." "But in those circumstances, they have no legal status," Jay protested. Colonel Thompson answered him, "Still, they have the consent of the people they govern, and that seems to be enough." Jay had heard this sort of thing before, from men who read too much philosophy. The idea that governments got their authority from the consent of the people was dangerous nonsense. The implication was that kings had no right to rule. It was the kind of thing John Wilkes was saying back at home. Jay began to get angry with Thompson. "In London, a man can be jailed for talking that way, Colonel," he said.
"Quite," said Thompson enigmatically.
Lizzie intervened.
"Have you tried the syllabub, Mrs. Thompson?"
The Colonel's wife responded with exaggerated enthusiasm.
"Yes, it's very good, quite delicious. I'm so glad. Syllabub can so easily go wrong."
Jay knew that Lizzie could not care less about syllabub. She was trying to move the conversation away from politics, but he had not finished. "I must say I'm surprised by some of your attitudes, Colonel," he said.
"Ah, I see Dr. Finch. I must have a word with him," Thompson said, and smoothly moved with his wife to another group.
Bill Delahaye said, "You've only just arrived, Jamison. You may find that living here for a while gives you a different perspective." His tone was not unkind, but he was saying Jay did not yet know enough to have a view of his own. Jay was offended.
"I trust, sir, that my loyalty to my sovereign will be unshaken, no matter where I may choose to live."
Delahaye's face darkened. "No doubt," he said, and he too moved away, taking his wife with him. Roderick Armstead said,
"I must try this syllabub,"
and turned to the table, leaving Jay and Lizzie with his drunk brother.
"Politics and religion," said John Armstead. "Never talk about politics and religion at a party."
And with that he leaned backwards, closed his eyes, and fell flat. Jay came down to breakfast at midday. He had a headache. He had not seen Lizzie. They had adjoining bedrooms, a luxury they had not been able to afford in London. However, he found her eating grilled ham while the house slaves cleaned up after the ball. There was a letter for him. He sat down and opened it, but before he could read it, Lizzie glared at him and said,
"Why on earth did you start that quarrel last night?"
"What quarrel?"
"With Thompson and Delahaye, of course."
"It wasn't a quarrel, it was a discussion.
You've offended our nearest neighbours."
"Then they're too easily offended."
"You practically called Colonel Thompson a traitor."
"It seems to me he probably is a traitor."
"He's a landowner, a member of the House of Burgesses, and a retired officer. How in the name of heaven can he be a traitor?"
"You heard him talk.
That's obviously normal here."
"Well, it's never going to be normal in my house." Sarah, the cook, came in, interrupting the argument. Jay ordered tea and toast. Lizzie got the last word, as always.
"After spending all that money to get to know our neighbours, you succeeded in making them dislike you."
She resumed eating. Jay looked at his letter. It was from a lawyer in Williamsburg. "Duke of Gloucester Street, Williamsburg, 29th August, 1768. I am commanded to write to you, dear Mr. Jamison, by your father, Sir George. I welcome you to Virginia, and hope that we shall soon have the pleasure of seeing you here in the colonial capital." Jay was surprised. This was uncharacteristically thoughtful of his father. Would he start to be kind, now that Jay was half a world away?
"Until then, please let me know if I may be of any assistance. I know that you have taken over a plantation in difficulties, and that you may choose to seek financial help. Allow me to offer my services, should you require a mortgage. I am sure a lender could be found without difficulty. I remain, sir, your most humble and obedient servant, Matthew Murchman."
Jay smiled. This was just what he needed. The repair and redecoration of the house and the lavish party had already put him up to his neck in debt with local merchants, and Sowerby kept asking for supplies, seed, new tools, clothes for the slaves, rope, paint, the list was endless.
"Well, you needn't worry about money any longer," he said to Lizzie as he put down the letter. She looked sceptical.
"I'm going to Williamsburg," he said. Chapter 28. While Jay was in Williamsburg, Lizzie got a letter from her mother. The first thing that struck her about it was the return address. The manse, St. John's Church, Aberdeen. What was Mother doing in a vicarage in Aberdeen? She read on.
"August 15th, 1768. I have so much to tell you, my dear daughter, but I must take care to write it step by step as it happened. Soon after I returned to Hindlane, your brother-in-law, Robert Jamison, took over the management of the estate.
Sir George is now paying the interest on my mortgages, so I am in no position to argue. Robert asked me to leave the big house and live in the old hunting lodge for the sake of economy. I confess I was not best pleased with the arrangement, but he insisted, and I have to tell you he was not as pleasant or affectionate as a family member might be. A surge of impotent anger possessed Lizzie. How dare Robert evict Lizzie's mother from her home? She recalled his words after she had rejected him and accepted Jay. Even if I can't have you, I'll still have Hyde Glen. It had seemed impossible at the time, but now it had come true. Gritting her teeth, she continued to read.
Then the Reverend Mr. York announced that he was leaving us. He has been pastor at Hugh for 15 years, and he is my oldest friend. I understood that after the tragic early death of his wife, he felt the need to go and live in a new place. But you may imagine how distraught I was that he was leaving just when I needed friends. Then the most astonishing thing happened. My dear, I blush to tell you that he asked me to marry him, and I accepted.
Good God,
Lizzie said aloud. So you see we are wed and have moved to Aberdeen from where I write. Many will say I married beneath myself, being the widow of Lord Hallam. But I know how worthless a title is, and John cares nothing for what society people think. We live quietly, and I am known as Mrs. York, and I am happier now than I ever have been. There was more about her 3 stepchildren, the servants at the manse, Mr. York's first sermon, and the ladies in the congregation, but Lizzie was too shocked to take it in. She had never thought of her mother remarrying. There was no reason why not, of course. Mother was only 40. She might even have more children. It was not impossible. What shocked Lizzie was a sense of being cast adrift. Hyde Glen had always been her home. Although her life was here in Virginia with her husband and her baby, she had thought of Hyde Glen House as a place she could always return to if she really needed sanctuary. But now it was in the hands of Robert. Lizzie had always been the center of her mother's life. It had never occurred to her that this would change. But now her mother was a minister's wife living in Aberdeen with 3 stepchildren to love and care for, and she might even be expecting a new baby of her own. It meant Lizzie had no home but this plantation, no family but Jay. Well, she was determined to make a good life for herself here. She had privileges many women would envy. A big house, an estate of 1,000 acres, a handsome husband, and slaves to do her bidding. The house slaves had taken her to their hearts. Sarah was the cook, Fat Bell did most of the cleaning, and Mildred was her personal maid and also served at table sometimes. Bell had a 12-year-old son, Jimmy, who was the stable boy. His father had been sold away years ago. Lizzie had not yet got to know many of the field hands, apart from Mac, but she liked Kobe, the supervisor, and the blacksmith Cass, whose workshop was at the back of the house. The house was spacious and grand, but it had an empty, abandoned feel. It was too big. It would suit a family with 6 growing children, and a few aunts and grandparents, and troops of slaves to light fires in every room and serve vast communal dinners. For Lizzie and Jay it was a mausoleum. But the plantation was beautiful. Thick woodlands, broad sloping fields, and 100 little streams. She knew Jay was not quite the man she had taken him for. He was not the daring free spirit he had seemed to be when he took her down the coal mine. And his lying to her over mining in Hyde Glen had shaken her. After that, she could never feel the same about him. They no longer romped in bed in the mornings. They spent most of the day apart. They ate dinner and supper together, but they never sat in front of the fire, holding hands and talking of nothing in particular, the way they once had. But perhaps Jay was disappointed too. He might have similar feelings about her, that she was not as perfect as she had once seemed. There was no point in regrets. They had to love one another as they were today. All the same, she often felt a powerful urge to run away. But whenever she did, she remembered the child growing inside her. She could no longer think only of herself. Her baby needed its father. Jay did not talk about the baby much. He seemed uninterested. But he would change when it was born, especially if it was a boy. She put her letter in a drawer. When she had given the day's orders to the house slaves, she got her coat and went outside. The air was cool. It was now mid-October. They had been here 2 months. She headed across the lawn and down towards the river. She went on foot. She was past 6 months now, and she could feel the baby kick, sometimes painfully. She was afraid she might harm the baby if she rode. Still, she walked around the estate almost every day. It took her several hours. She was usually accompanied by Roy and Rex, two deer hounds Jay had bought. She kept a close eye on the work of the plantation, for Jay took no interest at all. She watched the processing of the tobacco and kept count of the bales. She saw the men cutting trees and making barrels. She looked at the cows and horses in the meadows and the chickens and geese in the yard. Today was Sunday, the hands' day of rest, and it gave her a special opportunity to poke around while Sowerby and Lennox were somewhere else. Roy followed her, but Rex lazily remained on the porch. The tobacco harvest was in. There was still a lot of work to do, processing the crop, sweating, stemming, stripping and pressing the leaves before they could be packed into hogsheads for the voyage to London or Glasgow. They were sowing winter wheat in the field they called Stream Quarter, and barley, rye and clover in Lower Oak. But they had come to the end of the period of most intensive activity, the time when they worked in the fields from dawn to dusk and then laboured on by candlelight in the tobacco sheds until midnight. The hands should have some reward, she thought, for all their effort. Even slaves and convicts needed encouragement. It occurred to her that she might give them a party. The more she thought about it, the more she liked the idea. Jay might be against it, but he would not be home for a couple of weeks. Williamsburg was 3 days away, so it could be over and done with by the time he returned. She walked along the bank of the Rappahannock River, turning the idea over in her mind. The river was shallow and rocky here, upstream from Fredericksburg, which marked the fall line, the limit of navigation. She skirted a clump of half-submerged bushes and stopped suddenly. A man was standing waist-deep in the water, washing, his broad back to her. It was McCash. Roy bristled, then recognized Mac. Lizzie had seen him naked in a river once before, almost a year ago. She remembered drying his skin with her petticoat. At the time it had seemed natural, but looking back, the scene had a strange quality, like a dream. The moonlight, the rushing water, the strong man looking so vulnerable, and the way she had embraced him and warmed him with her body. She held back now, watching him as he came out of the river. He was completely naked, as he had been that night. She remembered another moment from the past. One afternoon in Hyde Lane, she had surprised a young deer drinking in a burn. The sight came back to her like a picture. She had emerged from the trees and found herself a few feet away from a buck 2 or 3 years old. It had lifted its head and stared at her. The far bank of the stream had been steep, so the deer had been forced to move towards her. As it came out of the stream, the water glistened on its muscular flanks. Her rifle was in her hand, loaded and primed, but she could not shoot. Being so close seemed to make her too intimate with the beast. As she watched the water roll off Mac's skin, she thought that, despite all he had been through, he still had the powerful grace of a young animal. As he pulled on his breeches, Roy loped up to him. Mac looked up, saw Lizzie, and froze, startled. Then he said, "You might turn your back." "You might turn yours," she replied. "I was here first." "I own the place," she snapped. It was astonishing how quickly he could irritate her. He obviously felt he was every bit as good as her. She was a fine lady, and he was a convict farmhand, but to him that was no reason to show respect. It was the act of an arbitrary providence, and it did her no credit and brought him no shame. His audacity was annoying, but at least it was honest. McCash was never sly. Jay, by contrast, often mystified her. She did not know what was going on in his mind, and when she questioned him he became defensive, as if he were being accused of something. He seemed amused now as he tied the string that held up his breeches. "You own me, too," he said. She was looking at his chest. He was getting his muscles back. "And I've seen you naked before." Suddenly the tension was gone and they were laughing, just as they had outside the church when Esther told Mac to shut his gob. "I'm going to give a party for the field hands," she said. He pulled on his shirt. "What kind of party?" Lizzie found herself wishing he had left the shirt off a little longer. She liked looking at his body. "What kind would you like?" He looked thoughtful. "You could have a bonfire in the backyard. What the hands would like most of all would be a good meal with plenty of meat. They never get enough to eat."
"What food would they like?"
Hmm. He licked his lips. The smell of fried ham coming from the kitchen is so good it hurts. Everyone loves those sweet potatoes and wheat bread. The field hands never get anything but that coarse cornbread they call poon.
She was glad she had thought to talk to Mac about this. It was helpful.
What do they like to drink?
Rum. But some of the men get in a fighting mood when they drink. If I were you, I'd give them apple cider or beer.
Good idea.
How about some music? The Negroes love to dance and sing.
Lizzie was enjoying herself. It was fun planning a party with Mac.
All right, but who would play?
There's a free black called Pepper Jones who performs in the Ordinaries in Fredericksburg. You could hire him. He plays the banjo.
Lizzie knew that ordinary was the local term for a tavern, but she had never heard of a banjo.
What's that? She said.
I think it's an African instrument. Not as sweet as a fiddle, but more rhythmic.
How do you know about this man? When have you been to Fredericksburg?
A shadow crossed his face. I went once on a Sunday.
What for?
To look for Cora.
Did you find her?
No.
I'm sorry.
He shrugged. Everyone has lost somebody. He turned his face away, looking sad. She wanted to put her arms around him and comfort him, but she restrained herself. Pregnant though she was, she could not embrace anyone other than her husband. She made her voice cheerful again.
Do you think Pepper Jones could be persuaded to come here and perform?
I'm sure of it. I've seen him play in the slave quarters at the Thompson Plantation.
Lizzie was intrigued.
What were you doing there?
Visiting.
I never thought about slaves doing that kind of thing.
We have to have something in our lives other than work.
What do you do?
The young men love cockfights. They'll walk 10 miles to see one. The young women love the young men. The older ones just want to look at one another's babies and talk about brothers and sisters they've lost. And they sing. The Africans have these sad songs that they sing in harmony. You can't understand the words, but the tunes make your hair stand on end.
The coal miners used to sing.
He was silent for a moment.
Aye, we did.
She saw that she had made him sad.
Do you think you will ever go back to Hyde Glen?
No. Do you?
Tears came to her eyes.
No, she said. I don't think you or I will ever go back.
The baby kicked her and she said, ouch.
What?
Said Mac.
She put a hand on her bulge.
The baby is kicking. He doesn't want me to yearn for Hyde Glen. He's going to be a Virginian. Ow! He just did it again.
Does it really hurt?
Yes. Feel.
She took his hand and placed it on her belly. His fingers were hard and rough-skinned, but his touch was gentle. The baby was still. Mac said,
when is it due?
10 weeks.
What will you call it?
My husband has decided on Jonathan for a boy, Alicia for a girl.
The baby kicked again.
That's hard, Mac said, laughing. I'm not surprised you wince.
He took his hand away. She wished he had left it there a little longer. To hide her feelings, she changed the subject.
I'd better talk to Bill Sowerby about this party.
You haven't heard?
What?
Ah, Bill Sowerby has left.
Left? What do you mean?
He disappeared.
When?
2 nights ago.
Lizzie realized she had not seen Sowerby for a couple of days. She had not been alarmed, because she did not necessarily see him every day.
Did he say when he was coming back?
I don't know that he talked to anyone directly, but I'd say he isn't coming back at all.
Why?
He owes money to Sidney Lennox, a lot of money, and he can't pay.
Lizzie felt indignant.
And I suppose Lennox has been acting as overseer ever since.
It's only been one working day, but yes, he has.
I don't want that brute taking over the plantation, she said hotly.
Amen to that, Mac said with feeling. None of the hands wanted either.
Lizzie frowned suspiciously. Sowerby was owed a lot in wages. Jay had told him he would be paid when the first tobacco crop was sold.
Why had he not simply waited?
He could have paid his debts eventually.
He must have been frightened. Lennox had threatened him, she felt sure. The more she thought about it, the angrier she got.
I believe Lennox has forced Sowerby out, she said.
Mac nodded. I don't know much about it, but that's my guess, too. I've done battle with Lennox, and look what happened to me.
There was no self-pity in his tone, just a bitter practicality, but her heart went out to him. She touched his arm and said,
you should be proud.
You're brave and honourable. And Lennox is corrupt and savage, and what happens? He'll become overseer here. Then he'll steal enough from you, one way and another, to open a tavern in Fredericksburg, and soon he'll be living much as he did in London.
Not if I can help it, Lizzie said determinedly. I'm going to speak to him right away.
Lennox had a small two-room house down by the tobacco sheds, near Sowerby's house.
I hope he's at home.
He's not there now. At this time on a Sunday, he'll be at the ferry house. That's an ordinary 3 or 4 miles upriver from here. He'll stay there until late tonight.
Lizzie could not wait until tomorrow.
She had no patience when there was something like this in her mind.
I'll go to the ferry house. I can't ride. I'll take the pony trap.
Mac frowned. Wouldn't it be better to have it out with him here, where you're mistress of the house? He's a rough man. Lizzie felt a pang of fear. Mac was right. Lennox was dangerous. But she could not bear to postpone the confrontation. Mac could protect her.
Will you come with me? She said. I'd feel safe if you were there.
Of course.
You can drive the trap.
You'll have to teach me.
There's nothing to it.
They walked up from the river to the house. The stable boy, Jimmy, was watering the horses. Mac and he got the trap out and put a pony in the traces, while Lizzie went into the house to put on a hat. They drove out of the estate onto the riverside road and followed it upstream to the ferry crossing. The ferry house was a wood-frame building, not much bigger than the two-room houses lived in by Sowerby and Lennox. Lizzie let Mac help her down from the trap and hold open the door of the tavern for her. It was gloomy and smoky inside. 10 or 12 people sat on benches and wooden chairs, drinking from tankards and pottery cups. Some were playing cards and dice, others smoking pipes. The click of billiard balls came from the back room. There were no women and no blacks. Mac followed her in, but stood back, by the door, his face in shadow. A man came through a doorway from the back room, wiping his hands on a towel, and said, "What can I bring you, sir?"
"Oh, a lady."
"Nothing, thank you,"
Lizzie said in a clear voice, and the room went quiet. She looked around at the upturned faces. Lennox was in the corner, bent over a shaker and a pair of dice. The little table in front of him had several piles of small coins. His face showed resentment at being interrupted. He carefully scooped up his coins, taking his time, before he stood up and took off his hat.
"What are you doing here, Mrs. Jamieson?"
"I didn't come to play dice, obviously," she said crisply. "Where is Mr. Sowerby?"
She heard one or two approving murmurs, as if others in the place would like to know what had happened to Sowerby, and she saw a grey-haired man turn in his chair and look at her.
"He's run off, it seems," Lennox answered.
"Why haven't you reported this to me?"
Lennox shrugged.
"Because there's nothing you can do about it."
"I want to know about such things all the same. Don't do it again. Is that clear?"
Lennox made no reply.
"Why did Sowerby leave?"
"How should I know?" The grey-haired man piped up. "He owed money."
Lizzie turned to him.
"Who to?"
The man jerked a thumb.
"Lennox, that's who."
She turned back to Lennox.
"Is this true?"
"Yes."
"For what?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"Why did he borrow money from you?"
"He didn't, exactly. He lost it to me."
"Gambling?"
"Yes."
"And did you threaten him?"
The grey-haired man gave a sarcastic laugh.
"Did he? I'll swear." "I asked for my money," Lennox said coolly.
"And that drove him away?"
"I tell you, I don't know why he left."
"I believe he was frightened of you."
A nasty smile crossed Lennox's face.
"Many people are," he said,
and the threat in his voice was hardly veiled. Lizzie felt scared as well as angry.
"Let's get something clear," she said.
There was a tremor in her voice, and she swallowed to get it under control.
"I am the mistress of the plantation, and you will do what I say. I shall now take charge of the place until my husband returns. Then he will decide how to replace Mr. Sowerby."
Lennox shook his head.
"Oh, no," he said. "I'm Sowerby's deputy. Mr. Jamieson has told me quite particularly that I'm in charge if Sowerby should fall ill or anything. Besides, what do you know about tobacco growing?"
"As much as a London tavern keeper, at least."
"Well, that's not how Mr. Jamieson sees it, and I take my orders from him."
Lizzie could have screamed with frustration. She could not let this man give orders on her plantation.
"I'm warning you, Lennox, you'd better obey me."
"And if I don't?"
He took a step towards her, grinning, and she smelled his characteristic ripe odour. She was forced to step backwards. The other customers in the tavern sat frozen to their seats.
"What will you do, Mrs. Jamieson?"
he said, still coming towards her. "Knock me down." As he said this, he lifted his hand over his head, in a gesture that might have been an illustration of what he was saying, but could just as easily have been a threat. Lizzie gave a cry of fear and jumped back. Her legs came up against the seat of a chair, and she sat down with a bump. Suddenly Mac was there, standing between Lennox and her.
"You've raised your hand to a woman, Lennox," he said. "Now let's see you raise it to a man." "You," Lennox said. "I didn't know it was you, standing in the corner like a nigger. And now that you know, what are you going to do?" "You're a damn fool, Macash. You always take the losing side."
"You've just insulted the wife of the man who owns you. I don't call that clever."
"I didn't come here to argue. I came to play dice."
Lennox turned and went back to his table. Lizzie felt as angry and frustrated as she had when she arrived. She stood up.
"Let's go,"
she said to Mac. He opened the door and she went out. She had to know more about tobacco growing, she decided when she had calmed down. Lennox was going to try to take over, and the only way she could defeat him was by persuading Jay that she would do a better job. She already knew a good deal about the running of the plantation, but she did not really understand the plant itself. Next day she got out the pony and trap again and went over to Colonel Thompson's place, with Jimmy driving her. In the weeks since the party, the neighbours had been cool to Lizzie and Jay, particularly to Jay. They had been invited to big social occasions, a ball and a grand wedding reception, but no one had asked them to a small celebration or an intimate dinner. However, when Jay left for Williamsburg, they seemed to know, for since then Mrs. Thompson had called and Susie Delahaye had invited Lizzie to tea. It distressed her that they preferred her on her own, but Jay had offended everyone with his opinions. As she drove through the Thompson plantation, she was struck by how prosperous it looked. There were rows of hogsheads on the jetty. The slaves looked active and fit. The sheds were painted and the fields were neat. She saw the colonel across a meadow, talking to a small group of hands, pointing to show them something. Jay never stood in the fields giving instructions. Mrs. Thompson was a fat and kindly woman, past 50. The Thompson children, two boys, were both grown up and living elsewhere. She poured tea and asked about the pregnancy. Lizzie confessed that she had occasional backache and constant heartburn, and was relieved to hear that Mrs. Thompson had suffered exactly the same. She had also noticed slight bleeding once or twice, and Mrs. Thompson frowned and said that had not happened to her, but it was not uncommon, and she should rest more. But she had not come here to talk about pregnancy, and she was glad when the colonel came in for tea. He was in his 50s, tall and white-haired and vigorous for his age. He shook her hand stiffly, but she softened him with a smile and a compliment.
"Why does your plantation look so much more impressive than anyone else's?"
"Well, it's kind of you to say so," he replied. "I'd say the main factor is that I'm here. You see, Bill Delahaye is always going away to horse races and cockfights. John Armistead would rather drink than work, and his brother spends every afternoon playing billiards and throwing dice at the ferry house." He said nothing about Mockjack Hall.
"Why do your slaves look so energetic?"
"Now, that depends what you feed them." He was obviously enjoying sharing his expertise with this attractive young woman. "They can live on hominy and corn pone, but they'll work better if you give them salt fish every day and meat once a week. It's expensive, but not as bad as buying new slaves every few years."
"Why have so many plantations gone bankrupt recently?"
"You have to understand the tobacco plant. It exhausts the soil. After 4 or 5 years, the quality deteriorates. You have to switch the field to wheat or Indian corn and find new land for your tobacco."
"Why, you must be constantly clearing ground."
"Indeed. Every winter I clear woodland and open up new fields for cultivation."
"But you're fortunate. You have so much land."
"There's woodland aplenty on your place. And when that runs out, you should buy or rent more. The only way to grow tobacco is to keep moving."
"Does everyone do that?"
"No. Some get credit from merchants and hope the price of tobacco will go up to save them. Dick Richards, the previous owner of your place, followed that road, which is how come your father-in-law ended up owning the place."
End of side 14. Side 15. Lizzie did not tell him that Jay had gone to Williamsburg to borrow money.
We could clear Stafford Park in time for next spring.
Stafford Park was a piece of rough land separate from the main estate, 10 miles upriver. Because of the distance, it was neglected, and Jay had tried to lease or sell it, but there had been no takers.
"Why not start with Pond Copse?" said the Colonel. "It's close to your curing sheds, and the soil is right. Which reminds me," he glanced at the clock on the mantelpiece, "I have to visit my sheds before it gets dark."
Lizzie stood up. "I must get back and speak to my overseer."
Mrs. Thompson said, "Don't do too much, Mrs. Jamieson. Remember your baby." Lizzie smiled.
"I'm going to take plenty of rest, too, I promise."
Colonel Thompson kissed his wife, then walked out with Lizzie. He helped her onto the seat of the trap, then rode with her as far as his sheds. "If you'll forgive my making a personal comment, you're a remarkable young lady, Mrs. Jamieson."
"Why, thank you," she said.
"I hope we'll see more of you."
He smiled, and his blue eyes twinkled. He took her hand, and as he lifted it to kiss it, his arm brushed her breast, as if by accident.
"Please send for me any time I can help you in any way."
She drove off.
"I do believe I have just received my first adulterous proposition," she thought. "And me 6 months pregnant, the wicked old man."
She supposed she ought to be outraged, but in fact she was pleased. Of course she would never take him up on his offer. Indeed, she would be careful to avoid the Colonel from now on. But it was flattering to be thought desirable.
"Let's go faster, Jimmy," she said. "I want my supper."
Next morning she sent Jimmy to summon Lennox to her drawing-room. She had not spoken to him since the incident in the ferry house. She was more than a little afraid of him, and she considered sending for Mac as a protection. But she refused to believe she needed a bodyguard in her own house. She sat in a big carved chair that must have been brought from Britain a century ago. Lennox arrived 2 hours later, with mud on his boots. She knew the delay was his way of showing he was not obliged to jump when she whistled. If she challenged him, he was sure to have some excuse, so she decided to act as if he had come immediately.
"We are going to clear Pond Copse ready for tobacco planting next spring," she said. "I want you to begin today."
For once he was taken by surprise.
"Why?"
he said.
"Tobacco farmers must clear new land every winter. It's the only way to maintain high yields. I've looked around, and Pond Copse seems the most promising. Colonel Thompson agrees with me."
"Bill Sowerby never did that."
"Bill Sowerby never made any money."
"There's nothing wrong with the old fields."
"Tobacco cultivation exhausts the land."
"Oh, yes," he said, "but we manure heavily."
She frowned. Thompson had not mentioned manuring. "I don't know..."
Her hesitation was fatal. "These things are best left to men," he said.
"Never mind the homilies," she snapped. "Tell me about the manuring."
"We pen the cattle in the tobacco fields at night for the manure. It refreshes the land for the next season."
"It can't be as good as new land," she said, but she was not sure.
"It's just the same," he insisted. "But if you want a change, you'll have to speak to Mr. Jamieson."
She hated to let Lennox win, even temporarily, but she would have to wait until Jay returned. Feeling irritated, she said, "You can go now." He gave a little smile of victory and went out without another word. She forced herself to rest for the remainder of the day, but on the following morning she made her usual tour of the plantation. In the sheds, the bundles of drying tobacco plants were being taken down from their hooks so that the leaves could be separated from the stems and the heavy fibres stripped out. Next, they would be bundled up again and covered with cloth to sweat. Some of the hands were in the woods, cutting wood to make barrels. Others were sowing winter wheat in stream quarter. Lizzie spotted Mac there, working alongside a young black woman. They crossed the ploughed field in a line, distributing the seed from heavy baskets. Lennox followed, hurrying the slower workers with a kick or a touch of the whip. It was a short whip, with a hard handle and a lash 2 or 3 feet long, made of some flexible wood. After he noticed Lizzie watching, he began to use it more freely, as if challenging her to try and stop him. She turned away and started back towards the house. But before she was out of earshot, she heard a cry and turned back. The hand working next to Mac had collapsed. It was Bess, an adolescent girl about 15 years old, tall and thin. Lizzie's mother would have said she had outgrown her strength. Lizzie hurried towards the prone figure, but Mac was nearer. He put down his basket and knelt beside Bess. He touched her forehead and her hands.
I think she's just fainted, he said. Lennox came up and kicked the girl in the ribs with a heavily booted foot. Her body jerked with the impact, but her eyes did not open. Lizzie cried out, Stop it! Don't kick her! Lazy black bitch! I'll teach her a lesson, Lennox said, and he drew back the arm that held the whip. Don't you dare! Lizzie said furiously. He brought the whip down on the back of the unconscious girl. Max sprang to his feet. Stop! Lizzie cried. Lennox lifted the whip again. Max stood between Lennox and Bess. Your mistress told you to stop, Max said. Lennox changed his grip and slashed Mac across the face. Max staggered sideways and his hand flew to his face. A purplish weal appeared immediately on his cheek and blood trickled between his lips. Lennox raised his whip hand again, but the blow never fell. Lizzie hardly saw what happened, it was so quick, but in a moment Lennox was flat on the ground, groaning, and Mac had the whip. He took it in both hands and snapped it over his knee, then contemptuously threw it at Lennox. Lizzie felt a surge of triumph. The bully was broken. Everyone stood around, staring for a long moment. Then Lizzie said, Get on with your work, everyone. The hands turned away and recommenced sowing seed. Lennox got to his feet, staring at Mac evilly. Can you carry Bess to the house? Lizzie asked Mac. Of course. He picked her up in his arms. They walked back across the fields to the house and took her into the kitchen, which was an outbuilding at the back. By the time Mac put her down in a chair, she had recovered consciousness. Sarah, the cook, was a middle-aged black woman, always in a sweat. Lizzie sent her to fetch some of Jay's brandy. After a sip, Bess declared she felt all right, except for bruised ribs, and she could not understand why she had fainted. Lizzie told her to have something to eat and rest until tomorrow. Leaving the kitchen, she noticed that Mac looked solemn. What is it? She said. I must have been mad, he said. How can you say that? She protested. Lennox disobeyed a direct order from me. He's a vengeful man. I shouldn't have humiliated him. How can he take revenge on you? Easily. He's the overseer. I won't allow it, Lizzie said decisively. You can't watch over me all day. Curse it! She could not allow Mac to suffer for what he had done. I'd run away if I knew where to go. Have you ever seen a map of Virginia? Don't run away. She frowned, thinking. Then she was struck by an idea. I know what to do. You can work in the house. He smiled. I'd love to. I might not be much of a butler, though. No, no, not a servant. You could be in charge of repairs. I have to have the nursery painted and fixed up. He looked suspicious. Do you really mean it? Of course. It would be just wonderful to get away from Lennox. Then you shall. You can't possibly understand what good news this is. For me, too. I'll feel safer with you close by. I'm frightened of Lennox, too. With reason. You'll have to have a new shirt and a waistcoat and house shoes. She would enjoy dressing him in good clothes. Such luxury, he said, grinning. That's settled, she said decisively. You can start right away. The house slaves were a little grumpy about the party at first. They looked down on the field hands. Sarah, in particular, resented having to cook for trash that eats hominy and corn pone. But Lizzie mocked their snobbery and jollied them along, and in the end they entered into the spirit of it. At sundown on Saturday, the kitchen staff were cooking up a banquet. Pepper Jones, the banjo player, had arrived drunk at midday. McCash had made him drink gallons of tea, then put him to sleep in an outhouse, and he was now sober again. His instrument had four catgut strings stretched over a gourd, and the sound, as he tuned it, was halfway between a piano and a drum. As she went around the yard, checking on the preparations, Lizzie felt excited. She was looking forward to the celebration. She would not join in the jollity, of course. She had to play Lady Bountiful, serene and aloof. But she would enjoy watching other people let their hair down. When darkness fell, all was ready. A new barrel of cider had been tapped. Several fat hams were sizzling over open fires. Hundreds of sweet potatoes were cooking in cauldrons of boiling water. And long 4-pound loaves of white bread stood waiting to be sliced. Lizzie paced up and down impatiently, waiting for the slaves to come in from the fields. She had sometimes heard them from a distance, singing plaintive laments or rhythmic work songs, but they always stopped when one of the masters came near. As the moon rose, the old women came up from the quarters, with the babies on their hips and the toddlers trailing behind. They did not know where the field hands were. They fed them in the morning, then did not see them until the end of the day. The hands knew they were to come up to the house tonight. Lizzie had told Kobe to make sure everyone understood, and he was always reliable. She had been too busy to go out into the fields, but she supposed they must have been working at the farthermost reaches of the plantation, and so were taking a long time to return. She hoped the sweet potatoes would not overcook and turn to mush. Time went by, and no one appeared. When it had been dark for an hour, she admitted to herself that something had gone wrong. With anger mounting in her breast, she summoned McCash and said, "Get Lennox up here." It took almost an hour, but eventually McCash returned with Lennox, who had obviously started his evening's drinking already. By this time, Lizzie was furious.
"Where are the field hands?" she demanded. "They should be here."
"Oh, yes," Lennox said, speaking slowly and deliberately. "That was not possible today."
His insolence warned her that he had found some foolproof way to frustrate her plans.
"What the devil do you mean, not possible?" she said.
"They've been cutting wood for barrels on Stafford Park."
Stafford Park was 10 miles upriver.
"There's a few days' work to be done, so we made camp. The hands will stay there with Kobe until we finish."
"You didn't have to cut wood today?"
"No time like the present."
He had done it to defy her. It was enough to make her scream. But until Jay came home, there was nothing she could do. Lennox looked at the food on the trestle tables.
"Pity, really," he said, barely concealing his glee.
He reached out with a dirty hand and tore a piece of ham off a joint. Without thinking, Lizzie picked up a long-handled carving fork and stabbed the back of his hand, saying,
"Put that down!"
He squealed in pain and dropped the meat. Lizzie pulled the prongs of the fork out of his hand. He roared with pain again.
"You mad cow!" he yelled. "Get out of here and stay out of my sight until my husband comes home," Lizzie said.
He stared furiously at her, as if he was about to attack her for a long moment. Then he clamped his bleeding hand under his armpit and hurried away. Lizzie felt tears spring to her eyes. Not wanting the staff to see her cry, she turned and ran into the house. As soon as she was alone in the drawing room, she began to sob with frustration. She felt wretched and alone. After a minute, she heard the door open. Mac's voice said,
"I'm sorry."
His sympathy made her cry fresh tears. A moment later, she felt his arms around her. It was deeply comforting. She laid her head on his shoulder and cried and cried. He stroked her hair and kissed her tears. Slowly her sobs became quieter and her grief eased. She wished he could hold her like this all night. Then she realized what she was doing. She pulled away from him in horror. She was a married woman and 6 months pregnant, and she had let a servant kiss her.
"What am I thinking about?" she said unbelievingly.
"You're not thinking," he said.
"I am now," she said. "Go away."
Looking sad, he turned and left the room. Chapter 29. On the day after Lizzie's failed party, Mac heard news of Cora. It was Sunday, and he went into Fredericksburg wearing his new clothes. He needed to free his mind of thoughts of Lizzie Jamison, her springy black hair and her soft cheeks and her salt tears. Pepper Jones, who had stayed in the slave quarters overnight, went with him, carrying his banjo. Pepper was a thin, energetic man, about 50 years old. His fluent English indicated he had been in America for many years. Mac asked him,
"How did you come to be free?"
"Born free," he replied. "My ma was white, although it don't show. My daddy was a runaway, recaptured before I was born. I never saw him."
Whenever he got the chance, Mac asked questions about running away.
"Is it right what Kobe says, that all runaways get caught?"
Pepper laughed. "Hell no. Most get caught, but most are stupid. That's how come they were captured in the first place."
"So if you're not stupid," he shrugged.
"It ain't easy. As soon as you run away, the master puts an advertisement in the newspaper giving your description and the clothes you were wearing."
Clothes were so costly that it would be difficult for runaways to change.
"But you could keep out of sight."
"Got to eat, though. That means you need a job if you stay inside the colonies, and any man that's going to employ you has probably read about you in the newspaper."
"These planters really have things worked out."
"It's not surprising. All the plantations are worked by slaves, convicts, and indentured servants. If they didn't have a system for catching runaways, the planters would have starved a long time ago.
Mike was thoughtful.
But you said if you stay inside the colonies, what do you mean by that?
West of here is the mountains, and on the other side of the mountains, the wilderness. No newspapers there, no plantations either. No sheriffs, no judges, no hangmen.
How big is the territory?
I don't know. Some say it stretches for hundreds of miles before you come to the sea again, but I never met anyone who's been there.
Mac had talked about the wilderness with many people, but Pepper was the first he felt inclined to rely on. Others retailed what were obviously fantastic stories in place of hard facts. Pepper at least admitted that he did not know everything. As always, Mac found it exciting to talk about.
Surely a man could disappear over the mountains and never be found.
That's the truth. Also, he could be scalped by Indians and killed by mountain lions. Most likely, he could starve to death.
How do you know?
I've met pioneers who came back. They break their backs for a few years, turning a perfectly good piece of land into a useless patch of mud. Then they quit.
But some succeed.
Must do, I guess. Otherwise, there wouldn't be no such place as America.
West of here, you said, Mac mused. How far are the mountains?
About 100 miles, they say.
So close.
It's farther than you think.
They were offered a ride by one of Colonel Thompson's slaves, who was driving a cart into town. Slaves and convicts always gave one another rides on the roads of Virginia. The town was busy. Sunday was the day the field hands from the plantations round about came in to go to church, or get drunk, or both. Some of the convicts looked down on the slaves, but Mac considered he had no reason to feel superior. Consequently, he had many friends and acquaintances, and people hailed him at every corner. They went to Whitey Jones's ordinary. Whitey was so called because of his colouring, a mixture of black and white, and he sold liquor to blacks even though it was against the law. He could converse equally well in the pidgin spoken by the majority of slaves or the Virginian dialect of the American-born. His tavern was a low-ceilinged room smelling of wood smoke, full of blacks and poor whites playing cards and drinking. Mac had no money, but Pepper Jones had been paid by Lizzie, and he bought Mac a quart of ale. Mac enjoyed the beer, a rare treat nowadays. While they were drinking, Pepper said,
"Hey, Whitey, have you ever run into anyone who crossed the mountains?"
"Sure have," Whitey said. "There was a trapper in here one time. Said it was the best hunting he ever saw, over there. Seems a whole gang of them goes over there every year and comes back loaded down with pelts."
Mac said, "Did he tell you what route he took?"
"Seems to me he said there was a pass called the Cumberland Gap."
"Cumberland Gap," Mac repeated. Whitey said,
"Say, Mac, weren't you asking after a white girl called Cora?"
Mac's heart leaped. "Yes. Have you heard tell of her?"
"Seen her. So I know why you're crazy for her." He rolled his eyes.
"Is she a pretty girl, Mac?"
Pepper teased.
"Prettier than you, Pepper. Come on, Whitey, where did you see her?"
"Down by the river.
She was wearing a green coat and carrying a basket, and she was getting the ferry over to Falmouth."
Mac smiled. The coat and the fact that she was taking the ferry instead of wading across the ford indicated that she had landed on her feet again. She must have been sold to someone kind.
"How did you know who she was?"
"The ferryman called her by name."
"She must be living on the Falmouth side of the river. That's why I didn't hear of her when I first asked around Fredericksburg."
"Well, you've heard of her now."
Mac swallowed the rest of his beer.
"And I'm going to find her. Whitey, you're a friend. Pepper, thanks for the beer.
Good luck."
Mac went out of town. Fredericksburg had been built just below the fall line of the Rappahannock River at the limit of navigation. Ocean-going ships could come this far, but less than a mile away, the river became rocky and nothing but a flatboat could negotiate it. Mac walked to the point where the water was shallow enough to wade across. He was full of excitement. Who had bought Cora? How was she living? And did she know what had become of Peg? If only he could locate the two of them and fulfill his promise, he could make serious plans to escape. For the last 3 months, he had been suppressing his yearning for freedom while he asked after Cora and Peg. But Pepper's talk of the wilderness beyond the mountains had brought it all back, and he longed to run away. He daydreamed about walking away from the plantation at nightfall, heading west, never again to work for an overseer with a whip.
He looked forward eagerly to seeing Cora. She probably would not be working today. Perhaps she could walk out with him. They might go somewhere secluded. As he thought about kissing her, he suffered a pang of guilt. He had woken up this morning thinking about kissing Lizzie Jamieson, and now he was having the same thoughts about Cora. But he was foolish to feel guilty about Lizzie. She was another man's wife, and there was no future for him with her. All the same, his excitement was tinged with discomfort. Falmouth was a smaller version of Fredericksburg. It had the same wharves, warehouses, taverns, and painted wood-frame homes. Mac could probably have called at every residence in a couple of hours. But, of course, Cora might live out of town. He went into the first tavern he came across and spoke to the proprietor.
"I'm looking for a young woman called Cora Higgins."
"Cora? She lives in the White House in the next corner. You'll probably see three cats sleeping on the porch." Mac's luck was in today. "Thank you." The man took a watch from his waistcoat pocket and glanced at it. "But she won't be there now. She'll be in church."
"I've seen the church. I'll go there."
Cora had never been a churchgoer, but perhaps her owner forced her to go, Mac thought as he went outside. He crossed the street and walked two blocks to the little wooden church. The service had ended, and the congregation were coming out, all in their Sunday best, shaking hands and chattering. Mac saw Cora right away. He smiled broadly when he saw her. She certainly had been lucky. The starved, filthy woman he had left on the Rosebud might have been a different person. Cora was her old self. Clear skin, glossy hair, rounded figure. She was as well-dressed as ever, in a dark brown coat and a wool skirt, and she wore good boots. He was suddenly glad he had the new shirt and waistcoat Lizzie had given him. Cora was talking animatedly to an old woman with a cane. She broke off her conversation as he approached her.
"Mac," she said delightedly, "this is a miracle."
He opened his arms to embrace her, but she held out a hand to shake, and he guessed she did not want to make an exhibition outside the church. He took her hand in both of his and said,
"You look wonderful."
She smelled good, too. Not the spicy, woody perfume she had favoured in London, but a lighter, floral smell that was more ladylike.
"What happened to you?" she said, withdrawing her hand. "Who brought you?" "I'm on the Jamieson plantation, and Lennox is the overseer." "Did he hit your face?"
Mac touched the sore place where Lennox had slashed him.
"Yes, but I took his whip from him and broke it in half."
She smiled.
"That's Mac, always in trouble."
"It is.
Have you any news of Peg?"
"She was taken off by the soul drivers, Bates and Makepeace." Mac's heart sank.
"Damn, it's going to be hard to find her. I always ask after her, but I've never heard anything."
"And who bought you?" "Somebody kind, by the look of you." As he spoke, a plump, richly dressed man in his 50s came up. Cora said,
"Here he is, Alexander Rowley, the tobacco broker."
"He obviously treats you well," Mac murmured. Rowley shook hands with the old woman and said a word to her, then turned to Mac.
Cora said, "This is Malachi McCash, an old friend of mine from London." "Mac, this is Mr. Rowley, my husband."
Mac stared, speechless. Rowley put a proprietorial arm around Cora's shoulders and at the same time shook Mac's hand.
"How do you do, McCash?" he said,
and without another word he swept Cora away.
"Why not?"
Mac thought as he